This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, as always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, that's pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
How are we doing today? So, I feel like the last few weeks we've had a very clear focus, which has been the emergence of the Zohar. And really grappling with these terms, allegory, mysticism, mythology, and this dramatic shift in consciousness that Am Yisrael is making around the turning point in Spain. Right? Now, I say that it sounds like a clear focus, but the reality is, as I hope I emphasize, that the emergence of the Zohar and this shift toward mysticism filling the role of philosophy, right, by which I mean, you know, aside from law, there always has to be some narrative that allows you to stitch the world together, right? Law as a sort of a bunch of rules can lead to a very desiccated, very dried out lifestyle. This is one of the challenges, not to point any fingers at anyone in the room, but I hear from my students who live in the modern Orthodox world in America, many of them find very challenging the lifestyle because the essential narrative is the American materialist narrative. Right, the goal is to just live a good life. However, the assumption of binding law is still very present within their societies, but the two don't work well together. Right, if your goal is to make money and live a comfortable material life, then you don't really want a bunch of rules that constrain you in the workplace, in the social environment, or in any other way. And so there's a challenge I've seen both in my students that come here and in speaking with friends who are raising their kids there, how do you adapt the sort of modern Orthodox lifestyle to the narrative of American materialism? By the way, and this will bear on the rest of our class, it's not just my particular bee in the bonnet today, what's interesting to me is that my progressive students in the sort of the non-Orthodox world find it much easier. Because the narrative of social justice, which is also a very important narrative in Western society, in American society in particular, serves very well for the Jewish practice that they have adopted of tikkun olam, of fixing the world. And it's one of the, and there's lots in the backstory of why Reform Judaism is really American Judaism. I'm not going to go into it now, but the reason I'm mentioning it is because the Zohar and all this mysticism, all this conversation we've been having for a few weeks is going to sort of, it's a seed that's been planted, right? It's going to take some time. I mentioned to you on one hand, the Zohar gains incredible acceptance, despite the fact that there were people really in the very moment of its emergence who contested its veracity. Nevertheless, it has incredible acceptance almost from the word go, but it's an acceptance of the sort of intellectual mystic elite. The average person still does not know about it. We're going to talk a little bit more today about the, let's think about it for a second, 14th and early, perhaps early 15th century, and how this was a time of great breaking for a lot of the structures that had held Am Yisrael together through the Middle Ages. And for the Jews, and by the way, for the non-Jewish European world, the 14th century will lay the groundwork for the emergence of modernity. And it will be in early modernity that mysticism really supplants philosophy for a good couple hundred years as the sort of base level narrative on which religious life can rest. There'll be later phases when it comes to the Enlightenment, there'll be a return to philosophy, etc. And just to make a plug for the Omer program, we're actually going to jump a couple hundred years into modernity for the Omer program just to give people a taste of a different sort of type of history. But, okay, so what I want to do right now is just kind of a litany of woes. You guys ready? No, a lot of people actually look at Jewish history. What Sal Baron, the great scholar of Jewish history in America, he was actually the first, the lachrymose view of Jewish history. Like he had the first chair in Jewish history in an American university, and he fought against what he called this lachrymose view of Jewish history that, you know, they hated us, they killed us, and God saved us, let's eat. Which on one hand can be a very sort of like consistent view of Jewish history, but you know, as I've been encouraging you to think about, the way we tell the story of the past is a lot about how we live in the present and the future that we're constructing. So what kind of world do the Jews live in when we look at our history as a history of nothing other than suffering? Can I ask that you close that door? I don't know about you guys, but that beeping is making me a little wild, not sure what it is. But maybe it'll help if you close that. What? No, because closing it helped. Okay, either way. So there's a split which has developed in the Middle Ages in Am Yisrael between the culture of Ashkenaz and the culture of Sephard. And we've dealt with it in many ways. Well, apparently we're going to fail, but I don't want to spend too much energy on it. I'll just tune it out to the best of my ability. We've been focused on Ashkenaz because that was my mandate for the class. We've had one toe back and forth in Sephard, and we're going to actually need to step a little bit more seriously into the Iberian Peninsula today because there's going to be a bridging between these cultures. I want to draw basically an end to Ashkenazic culture. So what I'll do, just a big picture, is I'm going to race forward and give a bit of a big, sort of a big view of what happens to Ashkenazi Jewry. And then we're going to jump over to the Iberian Peninsula and speak about some matters of more substance rather than just dates and names. So the heart and soul of Ashkenazi culture at this point is represented by the culture of the Tosafists, if you recall. Right? These were the both lineal and intellectual descendants of Rashi, who, by returning the dialectic as a tool for learning the Gemara, really transformed the Gemara from the Gaonic perspective of a discrete body of knowledge which could be mastered and applied into this sort of ever-expanding universe of Torah, right? The great age of Torah exploration, as we called it. And the Tosafists, their project lasts from basically the early 12th century all the way down to basically what was considered the end of the period of the Tosafists is the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, right? But so before we get to him, well, I guess we can tell the story of Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher, don't have a tremendous amount of detail about his life. He's born in Cologne, which at the time was part of the Holy Roman Empire. He was a student of Rav Meir Mirotenberg. Rav Meir Mirotenberg was considered the last of the great Tosafists. The Rosh holds a middle place. Technically, and you should know if you're ever into Gemara learning, if you ever want to know what the Tosafists thought about a sugya, just look it up in the Rosh. You always get the bottom line. You know, it's a good thing if you're ever trying to just like cram for a Gemara quiz or something. In the Maharam, there's a famous story about the Maharam, which I bet many people know, is that he was imprisoned by a German prince, right? Some people say because of his intention to go to the land of Israel. There's a lot of questions about that. But either way, the famous story is that he was imprisoned and held for ransom. This was something that the non-Jewish authorities had figured out pretty quickly in Europe, is that the Jews hold pidyon shvuim, hold the redemption of captives, as a very high value, and therefore it's very valuable to take a captive Jew, right? You see the logic. And the Maharam famously refused to allow the Jews of the era, even though he was the great of Torah in his day, to redeem him for more than what he felt to be his worth, and being a humble person, he didn't think it was worth that much, right? And so he lived out his days in a tower, captive, but managed to actually continue to produce Torah. There are whole reams of his Torah. I've learned some Truvot that he wrote while in captivity. The ironic end of the story, or so legend goes, is that once he died and he could no longer argue against people redeeming him, that there was a wealthy Jew who ransomed his body on the condition that he would be allowed to be buried next to him. So, you know, in the end, he got the honor which he deserved. But the point is that his student, Rabbeinu Asher, inherited this whole tradition of the Tosafists. And it will be in the person of Rabbeinu Asher that the Torah of Ashkenaz migrates to the Iberian Peninsula. What do I mean? In 1306, life has been hard for the Jews in France for quite some time. Right? France, of course, being a bit of an anachronistic term at this point, right? Because you have many different provinces and kings and stuff. We're going to speak about the Hundred Years' War momentarily and the consolidation, the beginning of the consolidation of the nations of Europe. But we'll just call it France for the sake of our purposes. And in 1306, Philip the Fair, who was the king of France at the time, was out of cash, common problem for feudal monarchs. Right? And so when you're a feudal monarch and you're out of cash, what do? You soak the Jews. You could tax, but it's just so laborious, right? Whereas what he decided to do was actually expel all the Jews from France. And in doing so, he took possession of all their property. And historians agree that it's clear that this was about money because he also made himself possessor of their debts. I mean, he didn't expel them and annul their debts, which might have been a sort of a popular move. He expelled them and took all the notes of credit which they were holding and attempted to then collect the debts which they held. Now, there's a big question about how many Jews lived in France at this point. The only number given to us is by Graetz, the great 19th century Jewish historian who claims there were 100,000 Jews at this point who were expelled from France. Many, many people are skeptical of that number. It seems outrageously high for what we know of the population in general, much less of the Jews. We have no other number. But what I'll tell you is that the Jews are expelled in 1306. They're actually allowed back in only 9 years later. Guess why? Because it turned out the French economy went into the toilet as soon as they got rid of all the merchants, right? But apparently there are some great accounts about how the Christian moneylenders who tried to step into their place were much worse and far more cruel to their debtors. But the end of Jewry in France, really, they're expelled for good in 1394. And at that point, except for the contested areas of Alsace-Lorraine, what's known as the Rhineland, classic Ashkenaz, where Jews remain up until the French Revolution, it's basically there and in the borderlands with Spain, alternately known as Provence and Avignon. There's got a bunch of names in regions there. But the Jews in the heartland of France are gone at this point up until the French Revolution. They'll make their inroads back into major cities, but as a whole community, that's it. East. Right? And that's really the point of the story. I'm going to tell you, like, as much as I said I don't like this lachrymose view of Jewish history, of the litany of woes, nevertheless, we need to get a few things straight. This expulsion, which is going to send the Rosh doesn't go east. The Rosh goes west. The Rosh Rabbeinu Asher, he brings the whole Torah of the Tosfos to the Iberian Peninsula. We will follow him in the second half of the class. But I just want to just give you a sense of what's happening because there's a great, refuge, which lies on the horizon for the Jews. Anybody know what it is?
Poland.
Right? They just have to get there. Right? And so there's going to be a gradual process. Just like when I grew up in Cleveland, all the Jews lived in the eastern suburbs with the ones that border the city. And now they all live in the exurbs, where when I was growing up, it was like farm country and nary a Jew for a mile you would see, right? Now they're slowly migrating eastward. My hope is that within the next millennia or so, they'll make it here, right? So the late Middle Ages in Europe was migration eastward to Poland. And as we know about modernity, they didn't make it. But they do make it to Poland and they do find rest there for several hundred years. But we want to understand how they got there. Because at this point, right, Poland and the Russian Empire, which is not truly existent as an empire yet, but is coming online soon, have no Jews, almost no Jews. And we'll trace that history from the 13th century on in its own class, don't worry. But that was the reason. We're moving east gradually. So next piece in this picture is what's known as the Hundred Years' War. Now, the Hundred Years' War is a bit of a misnomer. It does last, actually. The dates I have here is from 1337 to 1453, which is actually more than 100 years. But the misnomer is not the 100 years. The misnomer is the word war. Right? When we talk about a war in our culture, we think of massive armies facing each other on the battlefield, right? Total war in that sort of Clausewitz sense. What you're looking at here is the collapse of feudal society over the course of 100 plus years. And that's what you want to take away from the Hundred Years' War. The Hundred Years' War is the collapse of feudal society. Nominally, the struggle is the rulers of the Kingdom of England against the House of Valois, which is a major house in continental France, over the French throne. Those of you who know a little bit of European history may remember that in 1066, William of Normandy, William the Conqueror, crosses from what we today call northern France. He crosses the Channel. He conquers the British Isles, drives the Anglo-Saxons back. Right, and that's why the English language has so much French in it. And it's also the Hundred Years' War why the English hate the French. Because what happened was the Hundred Years' War was a contest between the royal houses of the islands of England and the royal houses of continental France over basically who is going to be king. And it was very complex. I actually tried to do some research to explain it to you guys better, and I decided chalas. It is just not worth it for our story. It's actually not that important to start figuring out who was related to who and what. But you have to just remember that this is a system, the military agricultural system, as I characterize it to you guys, which is based on the principle of fealty, right? Everybody's swearing loyalty to someone else. And what starts to happen, very similar in many ways to the lead up to World War I, is that network of fealty just collapses on itself. At a certain point, I'm both in charge and your vassal, and your, you know, and your brother happens to be my cousin, and we're both married to the same two sisters, and like, it's just way too complex. And of course, you know, that level of political history is only the tip of the iceberg. Because what you're also dealing with is major socioeconomic struggles, shifting economies. Like, this is a big picture. But what we need to know for our story is a couple of things. First of all, for 100 years, multiple armies will rage their way across Europe. Now, most of this had to do with sieges. Just picture, when the weather's good, you'll lay siege to a city, right? And hopefully you'll get into it by the time the weather turns bad, where suddenly that city becomes your base for the winter, right? You will then, come spring, find another city to lay siege to, or if you are the besieged, you'll hopefully get rid of this army, and they'll move on somewhere else. And this is the way it goes back and forth through Europe. And as if this weren't bad enough, right? In the middle of this process, we're actually somewhere toward the beginning of it, in 1348, the Black Plague arrives in Europe. Right, dun, 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 dun. No, I mean, the Black Plague is transformative for European society. The population estimates are wildly variant. Anywhere from 30 to 80% of the populace of Europe dies, depending on the region you're dealing with. You are correct, Barbara, that there is a widespread libel against the Jews that they were responsible. I mean, most people have heard of this notion of the Jews poisoning the wells. There are some people who claim that the Jews were disproportionately saved from the plague because of our knowledge of hygiene. I did not find any reputable historian that is willing to say that. I think that's part of a counter-Jewish narrative. Like, you dirty goyim, you all died and said we poisoned the wells and we wash our hands before we eat. I did not see any reputable historian who was willing to back that. And I just tell that to you as a warning that Jews as victims become Jews as persecutors just like that. And narrative is one of the great tools of persecution. So just be aware that when we tell our stories, they're never neutral. Yeah? Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting that the Pope had population statistics at his command. But what I would point out to you is that we've said consistently it was never the institutional church that was interested in destroying the Jews. It was always the mob, and occasionally, you know, kings and princes, etc., who for their own political reasons. But the church, ever since the patristic Christianity and Augustine and the witness doctrine, has held that the Jews must survive, albeit in a degraded state, in order to testify both to the truth of Christian scriptures and to what it looks like when you reject salvation, right? And it's an eschatological endgame, meaning they believe in the time of the Messiah, the Jews will either be destroyed or convert, but in the meantime, they were to be protected. They had a protected status in the mind of the church. I have lots of records of really terrible stuff here, Jews getting burned en masse in the cities of Strasbourg, etc. I'm actually not really so interested in going through the details of horror. It doesn't serve any purpose in my mind. Especially, I mean, to be quite honest with you, once the Holocaust happens, you know, all of this in European Jewish culture becomes, and this is how the lachrymose version of Jewish history really comes into being, it all just gets balled up into one unending story of suffering. You understand what happens? Meaning you have many terrible incidents. They tend to be the ones which were recorded, right? And the birth of Jewish historiography post-expulsion from Spain, so we're talking about 16th century, many of the, one of them is called The Veil of Tears, right? The other one's called Shevet Yehuda. I mean, there are a number of books, The Consolation of Israel, that are come out of that 16th century culture, and much of what they do are lists of historical tragedies, along with, you know, important personalities, rabbinic chains of authority. Those are the two, tend to be the two backbones of Jewish historiography. You know, terrible events of exile and rabbinic leadership which saved us. So on that note, just to give the broad strokes, because I want you to understand one important point I'll make right at the end. So you have this expulsion from France. You have then this 100-year war, which takes place in Western Central Europe, which destroys the social fabric for everyone, not just the Jews. You know, the Jews don't seem to have suffered disproportionately from this war. They just suffered just along with everyone else. You have the Black Plague. Now, one important thing to know about the Black Plague, aside from how awful it was, you know what happens when you kill nearly half the population of a continent? Labor becomes extremely valuable. First of all, huge tracts of Europe went back to wilderness. Things that had been cultivated since the time of Rome went back to being forest. But what's critical sociologically in the long run is that the Black Plague contributes to the birth of modernity because of the elevation of the value of human labor. Right? The feudal system was based on the fact that human labor was little more valuable than animal labor, and that the serfs were slaves of the soil. Right? Remember, if I sold my property as a nobleman, you got everything, the manor, the fields, the outbuildings, and all those families that live on the property. And if those families try to run away, by law, I can bring them back in chains. They're not quite slaves because they can enter into personal contracts like marriage, which is one of the significant sort of rights of a free man in Europe, but they're bound to the soil. Serfdom collapses in the face of a labor shortage. It doesn't go overnight. These institutions don't disappear legally overnight. But the reality of the loss of such a population is one of the major gateways to one of the hallmarks of modernity, of course, is the rise of the centrality of the individual. And individuals have always been important in what we call high culture, right? Art, intellect, right? The nobility, right? But the spread of the importance of the individual into the mass of society, a lot of that's going to, the ways will be paved by the Black Plague, because from the simple fact that human labor suddenly becomes a major asset well above the value of that of cattle, right? So you need to just know that as a point of information for development. The other thing I would add is that by the end of the 100 Years' War, which lasted how long? That the feudal armies had largely been replaced by professional mercenary armies. You know, and that's another major shift. Right? The first professional armies that Europe has seen since the fall of the Western Roman Empire, which is about 1,000 years at this point, right, now exist at the end of the Hundred Years' War. That will be part and parcel, together with this battle between the rulers of England and the House of Valois in France. Who wins? House of Valois. They're the ones who become, ultimately, French monarchy. Right? We have the beginnings of the process of kingdoms. Remember, feudal structure is about interpersonal relationships. Right? It's more what we would call contract law than true political philosophy. Right? What happens out of the Hundred Years' War is that feudal society begins to collapse under its own weight. What emerges out of it is a new value to human labor, right? A new model of political organization, of a centralization of monarchy, which itself is going to pave the way for the emergence of nations as we know them, right? And one of the hallmarks of that will be a standing army, because don't forget, the whole model of feudalism, that what I call that agricultural, military agricultural complex, is that the king is somewhat beholden to the nobility for his ability to wield power, because he trusts them and depends upon them to muster troops for any major war he wants to fight. So it's in the king's interest to be able to have a standing army that allows him to wield power without being dependent upon the nobility. As a side note, much of the military technology that transforms from the Middle Ages to early modernity comes out of the Hundred Years' War. The heavy cavalry, which was the sort of armor core of feudalism, right, the knight in armor on horseback, doesn't disappear, but between the English longbow and the advent of what's called light cavalry, right, their significance is vastly reduced.
It's
It's a slow process. I'm just pointing out that England, for sure, at this point, it washes its hands of the continent and will become much... England's naturally, because of its boundaries as an island, is much easier to consolidate into what we think of classically today as a nation. France, with the advent of the victory of the House of Valois, will actually have a centralized monarchy, which will ultimately become the, you know, what are their names? The Bourbons, right? And in classic France that we think of. Not Germany. Germany will be a mess until Bismarck, right? Which is one of the things that actually prevents Europe from descending into total war. You know, Italy, never. I don't even go there right now. The next big question is Spain. Right, that lies at the end of our class. But there is actually one very important, or a couple of very important pieces to take out of this mix. Oh, just to add to it, right? Okay, so we had 1306, the expulsion of all the Jews from France. Then we have from 1337 to 1453, just picture Europe in a blender. Right, that's the Hundred Years' War. In the midst of that, you have the Black Plague. Did you hear all the hammer blows? It's just, right? And then, and the Jews, by the way, through this, are progressively migrating eastward. Where they're expelled from France. Most of them actually head east to the Rhineland, although many will go to Iberia, right? But what do they get then caught up in between France and Germany? The Hundred Years' War, right? They keep migrating eastward, and what catches up with them there in the mountains of like Bohemia is what's known as the Hussite Wars. The Hussite Wars, H-U-S-S-I-T-E. Again, one of these chapters in European history, which is not critical for us. Jan Hus was we would call today a Protestant, but this is before the Protestant Reformation, so he was called a heretic. I warned you about that whole heterodoxy, heresy thing, right? He had a different vision of Christianity than the Catholic Church. He also happened to be what seems to be a quasi-tribal leader. The Hussites had a very effective means of doing battle that had to do with wagons and flails and like a really complex, you want to look it up, it's really fun military history, not what we're doing today. But the key is that many of the Jews had settled exactly in the lands where the Catholic Church and the princely powers that were backing the church now descended on what ends up being what we would call the last continental crusade of Europe. Yet another blow. And the famous story there, and the character I wanted to pause on, is Rav Yaakov ben Moshe Molin, who's known as the Maharil, right? These take all the acronyms, sorry, the letters of his name, you make an acronym. He's born about 1365. He dies in 1427, which puts him right in the heart of the Hussite Wars, which happened in the first part of the 15th century, that there was imminent destruction. The army was gathered to sack the Jews in order to get the cash they needed to fight this war. He sends out a message to all of the communities of Germany, and they obey the call. They fast for 7 days in the fall of 1421, and suddenly the imperial army and the mercenaries that were mobilized at the city of Zaz disperse, and the legend goes that the very soldiers who threatened the Jews now came to beg bread and receive food from them. It's a nice story. Notice how I told you that the rabbinic personalities are always bound up with non-military salvation from non-Jewish military might. That is a theme. I'll say it again. Rabbinic personalities bound up with non-military salvation from non-Jewish military might. Right? It's one of the themes of Ashkenazi history. As opposed to like classic Sephardic history, which will pop up a bunch of rabbis who actually will, on horseback and shining knights, and like Shmuel HaNagid was probably the only Jew ever to march at the head of a Muslim army, as far as we know. So it's a very different approach to cultural history. But why does the Maharil matter, aside from the fact that it's a fun story? Because the Maharil is famous. Anybody know, anybody ever seen the works of the Maharil or seen them referenced? Whereas the Maharil, most people, if you learn halakha, you will encounter the Maharil in the works of a much later personality, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, who we will give due time and place to, don't worry. Or sometimes the Mishnah Berurah, if you spend time with Mishnah Berurah, will quote the Maharil, and when he quotes the Maharil, it's definitive. Because why? Because the Maharil is the bridge along which Ashkenazi Minhag is preserved. And this is actually the core of the story. This is why I laid the groundwork by giving you the litany of woes, even though I said I didn't want to. Right? all these hammer blows, 1306, the expulsion, the Hundred Years' War, the Black Plague, the Hussite Wars, right? And communities are being destroyed and transplanted. Destroyed and transplanted. Right? Not only does this sink into the Ashkenazi consciousness, which already lost its smile back in the Crusades, let's not forget, the idea that this is what it means to be a Jew, it presents a very particular problem, which is you may know what it means to be a Jew, but how do you know what to do in order to be Jewish? See, there's an essay that I'm sure that I've recommended you to before. It's called Rupture and Reconstruction by Rav U. Aaron Soloveitchik. Yes, I think it's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote it. Although you can, I have the essay, by the way, if people want to read it. It's a very important essay for understanding the nature of Orthodoxy in America today. If you want, you can send me an email. I'm happy to share it with you. You can also Google it, by the way. You can find it quite easily. It's called Rupture and Reconstruction. And in it, Rav Soloveitchik lays out two models of how we learn to be religious. Right? One is what he calls the mimetic. Copying, right? If you're a mime, you just copy what people do. But it's not a copy in the sense of imitation. It's in the sense that if you grow up in a religious house, then you just know how to keep kosher. Why? Because that's how we do it. Like I was in the kitchen with my mom or my dad or whomever, and that's like, that's how we do it. We don't mix these things. We keep those things there. I use this when I want to cut an onion. And if you ask me why, I'll probably tell you, I don't know. That's how we do it. It's the mimetic tradition. And it depends on a continuity of practice. You know, you learn from the people who come before you because you're in continual interaction with them. So the other stream within religiosity, or within particularly how one learns to be religious that he identifies, is through books, right? I mean, I deal with this all the time with my students, right? Students who have a great desire to live a Jewish life and may not have any knowledge because they lack a mimetic tradition, because they're, thank God, their families weren't expelled. They're just ignorant of Jewish tradition for whatever reason, right? American suburbia, you know the old joke, right? That Hebrew school did in two generations what 1,000 years of missionaries couldn't accomplish, right? No, it's sad, but there's some truth to it. How many people can relate to that statement, all right? But I'm still here today, thank God. So meaning it doesn't have to be catastrophic, awful causes for a disruption in tradition. Sometimes it's just prosaic, you know, well, I'm just trying to make a living, or yeah, I grew up religious and it didn't mean anything to me, so I raised my kids without the knowledge. I mean, it doesn't take much to break the mimetic. So what does someone like myself, who grew up in a very Jewish but not particularly halachic environment, do when they want to learn? You've got all the books. It's amazing. It is an amazing thing. Today, you can go into the library, forget Google and the internet, you can go into the Beit Midrash and you can figure out exactly what you need to do about everything. Now, there are some challenges that develop from this. Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, that's been a problem forever. We do things differently this way, we do things differently that way, and how do you figure out what to do amongst the books? We'll get to that in a second. But first of all, I just want to point out that one of the things that Rav Soloveitchik says in the essay, you know, that you take the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, one of the great halachic minds of Europe in the 18th century. One of the things that the Gra was very interested in was shiurei halacha, right? Measures when it comes to how much wine do you have to drink in order to actually fulfill the mitzvah kiddush, how much matzah do you have to eat? By the way, it's the size of a basketball, in case you're wondering. The olives in their days were very large. Measuring, it makes sense. Just remember that measurement, first of all, was a major problem of the ancient world. Measurement of any type, standardization of measure is one of the hallmarks of the progress of science and technology, right? And second of all, there is always just this question of the mimetic tradition, meaning it's nice to have a measurement, but, you know, if I'm living before the Hussite Wars, I've been in the same town in the Bohemian Mountains for 150 years, how do I know how much I drink for Kiddush? Well, I have his Kiddush cup, right? It's not just I watched my father do it. I have the same cup. And you know where he got it? From his father. He got it from me, right? Oh. So along come, not the cost, the Hussites or the Imperial Army, burn the house down. We escape with our lives, and the Kiddush cup is gone. Now, what do I do? So suddenly, down the line, the Gra hasn't been born yet, but let's say I look into the Maharil, who has the Minhagim. He's carried now. What's a Minhag? Customs. It's specifically what he was preserving was the practice of the Ashkenazim. It wasn't so much the technical halachic discourse, because the Tosfos had written that all the way up through what's known as the Or Zeruah, who we spoke about was one of the students of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, right? And from a technical halachic discourse, the structures of law were in place. But as Chuck pointed out, that's all well and good, but lech teda ma lasot. I can give you all the structures of law. You still don't necessarily know what to do, because you have to decide amongst all these crazy opinions. And the Tosfos and twisting the Gemara in knots and being able to tie it in bows don't necessarily help you. What helps you is what you've always done. So that's a very complex process that the Maharil has to decide. First of all, he's one part preserver, just multiple traditions, right? He's one part decider of what the mainstream tradition is. And that will have a real impact when we get to Poland. Just to push the story forward, you ask the average Ashkenazi Jew today, where's their family from? What will they tell you? Eastern Europe, Poland, you know. But remember, Ashkenaz is where? It's in Germany. How did that happen? Right? That happened because of the Maharil. No, he wasn't the only one. It happened because of a process through this disruption, this constant rupturing of almost 200 years, what was preserved was Ashkenazis. It became a transportable culture. And I would add to this from a psychosociological perspective that people in times of disruption cling extremely fast to any sense of continuity which they can find. And so therefore, the minhagim, which may have been somewhat fluid or contested or diverse when they were living the mimetic rooted tradition, will become fiercely contested and important under conditions of disruption. Yeah, Jeff. It's a great question. I want to leave Yiddish till we actually get to a full direct discussion of Poland. Yiddish is in formation right now.
It's in formation now.
Yes, because Yiddish is a product of Middle German, and it will really become an independent language the further the Jews get from Germany.
Okay.
Although you can divide, there's like a dividing line in Yiddish, which we'll speak about in Poland, between like the more German Yiddish, like I guess Yiddish, right, and Polish Yiddish. Apparently, this is the great dividing line across which some people eat latkes with sour cream and some with applesauce. So I've been told. And never the two shall meet, right? But we will talk about Yiddish. You're exactly right. The Yiddish is in a process, and because if customs are important to people for maintaining some sense of continuity, so language is all the more so. Galicia as a culture is going to emerge later in our story. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. It still lies a little bit to the east. So we have these two. I just want to finish the picture. So it's all well and good that you know how much you drink, because you have. It's not just you know what your father did. You have the cup that his father said. But so the house gets burned down, God forbid, and you guys are on the run. You resettle somewhere, and now you want to get a new. You're in Shlomi's, Judaica shop. You have to buy a new cup. Shlomi's got it according to the Chazanish, he's got it according to Rav Naveh, he's got all these cups, and it couldn't all be right, huh? So you look up in a book and you decide which I'm going to, and you know what you discover? That your family hasn't made Kiddush properly for 300 years. Now you laugh, but do not undervalue the power that lies in those books. Because if I can uproot you from the sense that your ancestors did exactly what they were supposed to do because of their organic way of life, then I can make you completely beholden to my knowledge base. And this is one of the things that Rav Soloveitchik points out, is that the mimetic tradition, the power base, and I'm sorry to get all Foucaultian on you, but the power base of the halachic system lies where? In the community rabbis. Why? Because a community rabbi may be deeply knowledgeable, and in Europe, many of the community rabbis were huge Talmidei Chachamim. They weren't like today, where we're just looking for a salary, right? Right. But what did they have to do every time they gave psak halacha? Every time they made some halachic decision? They study, and then, but everybody has to do that. Then what do they have to do? They didn't necessarily have to eliminate the other opinions. The most important thing, they had to still face their community. They actually lived in the midst of the world they created. And what happens is, Rav Soloveitchik points out, in the 20th century, after the greatest disruption that Ashkenazi Jewish will ever know, is that the power base shifts into the hands of the Rosh Yeshiva, into the heads of the academies, which, by the way, on one hand, makes perfect sense because the devastation of European learning means that the knowledge base of community rabbis is quite a bit lower, with all due respect to anybody out there who may be a community rabbi or listening, right? But it's deeper than that, because there's an effort after every disruption to rebuild not just what was, but what ought to have been. Right? And you may be very familiar with this in the flavor of American, even Israeli Orthodox, although the Israeli Orthodoxy has a lot of cross currents because of what it is to be a people in the land, but certainly in American Orthodoxy, that reconstruction of what ought to have been has a name. You know what it's called? Art Scroll. No, I'm not kidding. And I love it. I think the Art Scroll publications are phenomenal. I think they've done a great chesed for the English-speaking Jewish world, being able to jump people up in their knowledge base. But they are very particular in the world they believe they're trying to create, and therefore in the world they believe once existed. And I'm always trying to push you guys back to that understanding that anybody who has an image of the future, consciously or not, will shape their vision of the past accordingly. Because in the shtetl, everybody was happy, everybody was frum, things were good once upon a time, right? You've heard this before, even though what I just presented to you was not that at all, right? And so I'm just pointing out that this process of rupture and reconstruction, which here in the 14th century is a continual smashing and rebuilding as the Jews progress eastward until they ultimately reach Poland, and then you will have a real settling in Poland for several hundreds of years, and a whole new culture will flourish there that we'll speak about, God willing, when the time is right, right? But just beware that the dynamic which is set up there, and the 20th century takes on a very new guise, which is also because of many other things about modernity, which, God willing, we'll discuss during the Omer period. But there's one more piece before I want to add to that, and then I'll let you guys ask questions, and then we'll go back to what happened to the Rosh, because that's actually really the interesting portion of the story, in my opinion. So rupture and reconstruction, if you happen to, anybody here ever study of evolutionary biology? Yeah. Great. So that process may sound quite familiar to you, because it's also a process, you know, there's a big machloket, I think you can call it that, there's a big argument amongst evolutionary biologists about how new life comes to be, right? There's one camp called the gradualist camp, who says that basically evolution works slowly. All natural processes work slowly, right? That you know, the argument from design that a lot of Jews like to make, like, for instance, if I held this cup up and I said to you, did this cup come to be or did it have a maker? You would all say what? Has a maker. Clearly, why? Because it's got pictures and then. So if this cup has a maker, well then, what about the human body, which is infinitely more complex? Which is a really strong argument until you are willing to engage the fact that the universe is 15 billion years old. In which case, things begin to shift. Maybe. Right? Because evolution is quite a powerful force over gradual time. And that's one side of evolution. And by the way, evolution, of course, is not just a biological phenomenon. It's a, let's call it, existential phenomenon. Meaning that all complex systems are subject to evolution. Everything changes and grows. The other, therefore, also the Jews through time. The other perspective is what's known as punctuated equilibrium. Right? The truth is, most of the time, things don't change. Or if they change, they change very, very slowly. And as the great Jewish advocate of punctuated equilibrium, Stephen Jay Gould, said, what good is half an eye? meaning that gradualist approach has a lot of problems in understanding complexity. New structures that come into the world, like, really? Like, at one point I had 1/10 of an eye, and then I had, like, this gradual process, he's not buying it. So he says, what happens is that most of the time life just putters along without much interesting. Then all of a sudden, an asteroid streaks out of the sky, strikes the ocean right off of South America, you know, causes a massive volcanic eruption on the other side of the planet, the Deccan traps. And next thing you know, all the reptiles are dead, and those fuzzy little gerbils in the rocks will be sending a man to the moon soon. Right? Right? And so what's that called? It's called punctuated equilibrium, because there's a space which is created by destruction in which you have speciation. Right? That space which is opened up by destruction allows for the rapid filling with new growth. Now, why am I talking about this? Because aside from this rupture and reconstruction, which implies that the Jews always had the same thing, and we're just trying to rebuild it. And Rav Soloveitchik, as a religious and historical thinker, is just interested in the sociological problems that poses, in the dynamics of power, in the disempowerment of the Baal Tshuva, be they personally or communally-wise, of people's disempowerment around knowledge. You know, what I'm pointing out to you is that that's not the only process that happens. Sometimes something entirely new can fill that space. And that destruction space of the 14th century, which is happening, European Jewry mostly goes east, some goes west. What's, by the way, going to happen in the 15th and 16th century to the ones that go to Iberia? The exact same thing. And there's going to be a tremendous disruption. Into those spaces are going to emerge the two hallmarks of Jewish culture that will carry us into early modernity, which is mysticism, which we've already seen the roots of, and legalism. Now you're thinking, legalism's always been there, right? I mean, halakha, I mean, the Torah is full of commandments, and we've seen at least since the Mishnah, the consolidation of law, that's true. But law and legalism are not the same thing. In the same way that a traditional society and a traditionalist society are not the same. A traditional society is unselfconscious. We do what we do because that's the way we do it. Sound familiar? That's the mimetic. A traditionalist society says, we do what we do because I don't want to do it that way. There's a self-awareness. A traditional society doesn't have any awareness that there's any other way of being. A traditionalist society is fully aware, consciously or not, that there is another way of being, and then makes a choice to be traditional, and that is a fundamentally different creature. Right? That dynamic begins at this period. It's subtle. It will take quite some time before it plays itself out, but it happens really on the field of the two battles which are about to be decisively won. One is between mysticism and philosophy. We've been having this battle for quite some time, and we're going to play it out a little bit further momentarily, right? Two is between an organic lived tradition and legalism, right? That between a world in which the Jews do what they do because that's what they've always done, and a world in which now we need to know what to do, and therefore we're going to turn to legal codes, which will help us know how to do it. Excellent. So this is not a new dynamic. And that's where Salvation's point is very important, that rupture and reconstruction leads back to the mimetic tradition. Right? Every time you have a settled period of time, legalism and the sort of the book learning tradition will start to fade. It doesn't ever disappear because you will always have the intellectual elite that is engaged in that. You also have the need to adjudicate new questions, right, where you always turn to the books. But what happens is the organic process, well, is organic. It will always return. And it's very interesting to see, by the way, here in the land of Israel, remember, there's 70 years of the state, and the vast majority of the society is not only not religious, but at least in its early years, much of it was anti-religious. We're only starting to get around to a situation today where you're starting to sense the return of a bit of an organic religious process. And you know what's happening? Power struggles. It is not surprising. Power struggles. Because the rabbinic elite, who are the inheritors of the book knowledge, who managed through a very specific sociological process to, like, take control, are suddenly holding on to a tradition that a lot of the people who identify as religious... Like, how come the rabbi who decides who gets married, how you get married? Well, because they're the rabbis. Okay, I get that, but it doesn't really fit. There's a lot of discomfort around it. Give it another 100 years, please, God, and you'll see. You understand? I don't know your name. Mark, you don't understand the dynamic? I think you're entirely correct, right? And one of the reasons, perhaps, that we spoke about long ago, that the Mishnah was written in such an obtuse form was in order to try to ameliorate that. That at least there would have to be an organic process of students and teachers in a lived society, and it could be a superstructure rather than an answer book. But the knowledge industry progresses. Don't forget, the printing press hasn't even come into our story yet, which is going to be a revolution when we get there. And we're going to see the beginnings of that revolution today. Good, that's an excellent point. Thank you. Anything else? Did you guys get the picture that I'm trying to set up here? Is that there's two things going on. There's a society which, in its disruption, will always attempt to reconstruct itself, and that will cultivate loyalty to the past. And that's why the Maharil, right, in his Minhagim, right, will have such a status that he is the standard of what it is to be Ashkenaz. Even though, of course, there's all these Ashkenazi Jews out there. I mean, there's another standard. You could just look around, what are the Jews doing? What's the answer to that? Well, it depends on who you ask. It's quite diverse. Plus, it's been very disruptive, and, you know, and it won't really gel again until we get to come to rest in Poland. So that's one process, that how the disruption actually evokes a loyalty to at least a concept of the past. Because that's that traditional list. It's not really loyalty to the past. This is, by the way, I just really want to emphasize this. Traditional societies are incredibly flexible because of that lack of self-consciousness. Right? There's one of the greatest desires of human psychology is to believe that the way things are now are the way they've always been, even when you're living through massive changes. And so you see the sages, and often in the Mishnah, are able to integrate the most incredible innovations into a sense of continuity. Some of it is through mythic. Oh, it was Moshe and his, you know, Beit Din, like Moshe and his yeshiva. Ever notice how everybody in the Bible had a yeshiva? Right? That's not like rabbinic tongue-in-cheek. And it's not just simplistic, sort of like foundational myth-making. It's also a deep-seated need to see the world as having never changed, even as you're living through massive changes. And that type of continuity allows for evolution as opposed to revolution. And that's what we're after. And if you ever want to know the difference between evolution and revolution, just remember the birds. Where did the birds come from? The dinosaurs. Right? But there was never a sparrow that woke up in the morning and said, "Ah, yesterday I was a pterodactyl, what's going on?" Right? That process of evolution allows for a transformation which keeps a continuity of identity. Right? And that's how I can stand here and say, I'm a Jew, just like my ancestors in Ashkenaz, just like the Gaonim in Bavel, just like Judah Maccabee. Even though if we put those three, you know, categories here together, we probably all start to argue with each other. You're not a Jew. You don't look like a Jew, right? Even in practice, we would say. But there's a continuity of identity which necessitates the avoidance of revolution and relies upon evolution, because things that don't adapt, what happens to them? They die. Right? And whether you believe in evolution or not is not my issue. I'm here to tell you, you don't escape from that rule. Like, you can deny evolution from now until next Tuesday. That doesn't make it not true. So the rupture and reconstruction piece goes hand to hand with the opportunity for speciation, for new elements like the Zohar, which begins as this spark of light, as we spoke about in the Girona school. Wherever its origins are, its emergence is there, and it emerges into an environment which is ripe for it to just spread. Because the classic Midrash no longer speaks to the human condition of the late Middle Ages. Right? We spoke about how the German, the Hasidic Ashkenaz, had a lot of sort of practical mysticism, but they lacked an overarching narrative into which people could fit life, and that's going to have to wait for Spain. So right now, we're going to leave Ashkenaz, and it was a somewhat truncated version. Next, we're going to pick up with Ashkenaz will be the story of Poland. I'm going to jump with the Rosh in, back into Iberia, but questions or comments before we do that?
Yeah. Those are comments on the very first thing you said about the society in America as far as modern orthodoxy. I see it exactly the opposite way.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That the fact that you have this fourth day of rest, the fact that you have, you know, certain ways of eating, it just channels you in a different direction than, you know, your mighty dollar and everything goes and materialism. Right?
I hear you. If it works for you. What I'm saying is based on a lot of conversations. I taught for a number of years in the post-high school world. And I would point out to you, even if it works for you, it's not the ideal. Law and myth should work hand in hand, right? This is one of the reasons that the national religious sort of framework has such a powerful appeal, which has its own problems, trust me. I could deconstruct that for you too if I wanted to, right? But meaning the idea of a society in which it's an ad. I remember the rabbi of our shul once pointed out, there's a big argument. I live in Mali Adamim. It's an area of our country which is semi-arid, and there are lots of flowers in the, what are they called? Dividers in the roads. Like, they're always changing the flowers. It's a very pretty city, but like, what are you doing? It's like water, resource. So he said that there was a debate that happened in the city council in which the chief rabbi of the city argued that it was a mitzvah to have flowers because it was hidur mitzvah, the beautification of a city in the land of Israel. That's just a particular example that the materialism, right, is easily subsumed and elevated into the legal discourse. Now, that has its own problems. I'm not denying it, but I think that the ideal should always be that the myth and the myth and the law should be in tension. I think because you're making a very good point that tension can be very healthy, but ultimately should have a constructive. And I see a lot of my students suffering from it. But you know, I take the point that it's not necessarily all true, and certainly not for everybody. Other comments or questions?
Relation between Russia and Poland, is that together?
The population between Russia and Poland together? I don't understand the question. When?
The center of the learning, et cetera, et cetera. You said it was Poland. Wasn't Russia
the,
Poland?
The shift that's happening will be a shift to Poland. Right? The emergence of Russian Jewry will also be a later stage of that process. And even then, by the time Russian Jewry emerges, the center of learning has had the heart taken out of it in Ashkenaz, right? I mean, it's dispersed, but it's not what it is in, say, the 17th, 18th century Poland, but really 16th to 18th century Poland is a time which is comparable perhaps only to the time that the Gemara was written in terms of the concentration of Torah learning and the impact on daily life. Wait, but we're gonna talk about it. Poland, by the way, Poland was much bigger. Yeah, Poland was. We'll talk about the division of Poland and that whole thing. But what part of the problem here is the modern boundaries that we're speaking about are actually not the same as what was happening in early modernity. Okay, yeah, Mark. The Ramban, Nachmanides. Well, he actually ended up all the way in the Holy Land. He went from Christian Spain to the land of Israel. But we did speak a little bit about Provence, which was a culture, which was the cross-fertilization between the two.
Yeah, I'd just like to get a bit of clarification. You keep, and I agree with this, that you keep pointing out the importance of the narrative.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Which is very much tied in with the golden past that was, and we want to go back to this.
Sure.
Just the very word reformation was.
Yeah.
In Christian Europe meant to go back.
Renaissance.
To go back to something that was. And I just wanted to get a sense, was there any particular dynamic to the way the Jews might have done it versus others?
Yeah, that's a great question. That question really goes to the heart of messianism in Jewish culture.
Goes to the heart of?
Messianism.
Ah.
The messianic impulse, for lack of a better term, it has been around since the time of the prophets, right? The Afal Pi Shitmamea Im Kol Zeh Hakelora, even though he tarries, nevertheless I shall wait. It's just in a nutshell, and this will play itself out a little bit depending on where we get in Spain, probably next week. Professor Gershom Shalom, who I keep referring to because he is really the backbone of academic study in Jewish mysticism, he has a lot of writings on messianism. Again, I think I have a couple of his essays in digital format. If you guys want, you'll send me. Otherwise, you can Google them as well. He says that there's two primary impulses within Jewish messianic thought. What he calls the restorative and the utopian. Right? Like you can see it today. Right? Part of messianic thought is restoration. We're going to bring back the temple. We're going to have a king and a Sanhedrin. You know, there is that. So the neoclassical idealization of the past and projecting it on the future, which exists in many, if not all cultures, I don't know all cultures, certainly exists in many cultures, and particularly in European cultures, you're pointing out, plays a very important role at this point, is there. There's also the utopian, which is also the apocalyptic, which is Ein Lo Ra'ata, right? Which is like, we have no idea that what's coming defies imagination, and this is where you get all the way from Isaiah, like the lion will lay down with the lamb, and the child will play at the viper's pit, and that there's some sort of eschatological revolution which defies any notion of restoration because it's a world we have not seen. And so you see these two impulses or these two streams in thought, which, by the way, they freely commingle. There's no clear line between them. For instance, what's the third temple really going to be? Is it just like a rebuilding of the other ones, or is it like same idea, new content? Like, will there even be sacrifices in the third temple? Right? There's all kinds of so the two have a cross fertilization. But I would say that in Jewish thought that both coexist. Let's just say, and if you're interested, by the way, one of the great integrators of those two streams in Jewish thought is Rav Kook. Because on one hand his sort of classicist self, he was a master of the tradition. On the other hand, he was absolutely committed to the fact that he was living the footsteps of the Mashiach, and so therefore and attempting to push it along. So therefore he writes extensively about how the Torah of the Mashiach will be like make the Torah we know as empty vapors. There's a classic dream of the Baal Shem Tov, and then I'll stop. Because the Baal Shem Tov was a spiritual revolutionary in that sense. He wasn't just trying to restore things, even though he did believe he was restoring the path of the prophets. He was also trying to bring something new into the world. But apparently he had a dream where he descended into one of the lower pits of hell. And you know who he met there? Bilam, Jesus, and Shabtai Tzvi. Bilam's not fair. I think we're going to leave Bilam out of that. I think Bilam, I just slipped in there in my own mind. No, but sure, Jesus and Shabtai Tzvi. Now, it's very interesting. What do Jesus, Shabtai Tzvi, and the Baal Shem Tov all have in common? Yeah, they all understood that the classic confining structure of the Torah was insufficient. It might have been necessary insufficient. That was the Baal Shem Tov. Or it might have just been insufficient. That was Jesus and Shabtai Tzvi. But all of them understood that there was something lacking, that the messianic impulse is an apocalyptic impulse. It's going to, and then we'll see what comes. So anyway, I'll give you that to chew on. If we ever get to talk about the Baal Shem Tov, I'll tell you more. Shabtai Tzvi into the history arc, into that story?
Yeah.
Which one? That was a yes or no question.
When are we getting to that?
We're probably not, because he's in the 17th century, which lies in between where we're going to end this part and when the... So we'll pick up next year.
Okay.
We'll pick wherever, you guys should know, is that wherever we end off this year,
yeah.
We'll pick up next year. I'm doing the Omer series. They asked me to do a standalone, so I thought I would delve a little bit into the roots of the world in which we live today, modernity. Okay. Other questions or comments before we follow the Rosh into the Iberian Peninsula? All right. So I want you to picture the Rosh packs his bag with all the Torah, the Tosfos. He brings his family with him, right? Those that survive. And he heads into, not Spain, Iberia. Christian Spain at this point. Remember, the Jews, after 1265, it's an important date for us, the Reconquista stalls, right? And that Christian Spain comprises almost all of the Iberian Peninsula except for Granada, the sort of central southern portion across from the Straits of Gibraltar. It will be a stable situation for another 230 years or so, right, until finally in 1492 when Ferdinand and Isabella unite the peninsula into one country and crush Granada and, of course, expel the Jews. Right, why does that matter for us? Because the minute that the Reconquista stalls, the advantage, that's the privileged position that the Jews played begins to deteriorate overnight. And I pointed out to you last week or 2 weeks ago, I forget what it was, that's for two reasons, religious and socio-political. Right? The religious reason is that you have church triumphant right now. Right? The church has managed to push the Muslims in a corner in Iberia. The truth is, it's not going so well back there in the Crusades in the East, but we don't have to talk about that. Right? But it's feeling its oats, as it were, and therefore it's important to the church. That's, obviously, we're speaking to the church as if it was an entity, but it becomes important to finally win over the Jews, right? We spoke about the burning of the Talmud. We spoke about the disputation, the Ramban, right? So the other side of that is sociopolitically, the Jews, who had been very important tools of the reconquest, loyal, diligent servants, are now easily discarded. Now, it won't happen overnight. And of course, they do have a real power base. You can't just get rid of them. But from around the sort of late 13th century, the situation will be a steady deterioration. And in that will come a rise in messianic expectation and a cracking of Jewish culture. I want to talk about the second one first, and we'll come to the Messiah, or at least the expectations, at the end. Right? The fracture lines within Jewish culture we already know. Because what was the last big fight amongst the Spanish Jews about? Amongst themselves. Yes. Rambam was the focus, but the key is between the rationalist and the mystic camp. Or the rationalist and traditionalist camp, sorry. Rationalist and traditionalist camp. Right? We saw in 1232, right, the last round of the Maimonian conflict, right, that was actually the Ramban in between try to sort of make a compromise that we would let people learn the certain parts of Maimonides, wouldn't let them learn others. If you're 25 years old, we'd let you do this and that. Right? As every great compromiser, he failed. So a new round of this conflict is going to erupt more or less together with the Rosh's arrival in Spain. The Rosh arrives in Spain, Rabbeinu Asher, arrives in Spain, like I said, carrying the Torah of the Ashkenaz. And who does he meet? The Rashba, Rav Shlomo ibn Aderet, right? He is born in Barcelona in around 1235. He is the leader of Spanish Jewry until his death in 1310. He's a student of the Ramban, right? One of the most prolific halachic authors that the Middle Ages saw. We have, I think, over 3,000 tshuvot of the Rashba, which are extant. Right? That's a pretty impressive collection. And he was overjoyed to meet the Rosh, right? Got him a good job as the rabbi of Toledo, not Toledo, Toledo. I'm from Ohio, so that was funny to me. Just about when the Rosh arrived, right, this conflict over philosophy once again erupts. And let's just remember the basic issue at hand. The basic issue at hand is ever since Rav Sadia Gaon, there has been this, I might call it a subculture, there's been a significant portion of Jewish culture, particularly in Iberia, that believes that there are two paths to one truth, philosophy and revelation. Right? But what's been happening as the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim cultures have been mingling, if you're going to mingle successfully amongst those religions, your best bet is to downplay the particularist, revealed side of the discourse and to upplay the philosophical. Right? That's why in a secular civil society like America, it's a lot easier for Jews, Muslims, and Christians to just be part of the same society than it is in a religious ethnic society like Israel. Right? And so what's progressively happening within Iberia is even though the tagline is two paths to one truth, philosophy is overtaking religion, particularly amongst the intellectual and cultural elite. Right? And because of that, once again, there is a polemic which bursts out, and the Rosh puts pressure on the Rashba to issue a harem around 1305. Some of the dates are confused here. It's not clear to me when I was researching, did he do this by letter before he arrived? Is the number I have in 1306 not exactly when the Rosh got there? Maybe he got there a little earlier. Exactly when it happened is actually not the biggest issue. But the harem, written by the leader of Spanish Jewry, says, any member of the community who, being under the age of 25 years, shall study the works of the Greeks on natural science or metaphysics, whether in the original or in translation, is basically under the ban. They're under the harem, right? And further, I mean, I have a lot of details of this harem, which don't need to be read out right now. I just want to remind you guys of the three points of battle here so we can actually follow them to their end, which is going to take us a couple classes, right? The three points of battle between the traditionalists and the philosophers are theological, textual, and practical. Theologically, the philosophers are accused of denying miracles and traditional eschatology, the idea that the Messiah is actually going to be a person who will come and return the Jews physically to their land. Right? The denial of miracles, you can understand from Aristotelian philosophy, anything which doesn't fit the system doesn't fit the system. It's not true. Right? So miracles are the great expression of what's called in philosophy occasionalism, meaning that everything exists because God wills it so, not because there's natural law. Even if you tell me that God wills there to be natural law, which is what many of the religious thinkers, including the Rambam, held, is a quick step from there to deism, which in Europe, in say the 17th and 18th centuries, will be a big part of the sort of intellectual Christian crowd. Deism is that notion that of God as the great watchmaker, right? That God created the world with all of its intricacies, but then said, you know, bing, here you go. Now it's just going to tick away. Well, that sounds great, but what's the next step after deism? Atheism. Because like, as we say in the yeshivish, l'maynaf kamina, if God created the whole world and then walked away, so then what do I care if there's a God or not? And then if you start making good arguments about there not being a God, they start to held a lot more weight. As opposed to this notion that God's hashkacha, God's providence, is actually directing everything, in which case that really matters then, because I don't want to, you know, mess with the Almighty, right? So the undermining of the theological principles. Number two, textual. Right? What was the great textual battle between the philosophers and the traditionalists? You remember? Allegory. Right? This idea, in particular, when it came to Greek philosophy, and remember, allegory is that one-to-one relationship. Avraham is matter. Sarah is form. Yitzchak is the active intellect. Doesn't mean, like, myth, that they're living, because real people live mythic lives. And the fact that you could see the matter-form relationship within Abraham and Sarah's relationship, well, okay, so fine. That's something you can learn from it. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying it is an allegory, in which case, once you remove the exoteric, the external meaning, and you determine the esoteric, the inner meaning, then the inner meaning is all that matters. And that leads, of course, to the question of historicity. Were these real people? Right? Which is a challenge today, you know? And now, you think it's a challenge today. You ask people, did Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov really exist? Well, today, the Jewish people have re-embodied themselves as a nation in this land. And so, therefore, those questions are perhaps pressing, but they're not completely destructive. But in Christian Spain, in the 14th century, when you're surrounded by a society that not only says that they've replaced you, you're no longer Israel, God has rejected you, and the proof that God has rejected you is the fact that you're all miserable, under our thumb, but now is adding to that this idea from within. And in fact, there was no God that chose you in the first place. You can see how that would not be a popular opinion. Nevertheless, for those who had a need to reconcile the Torah with their intellectual structures, this should sound familiar, right? And therefore thought that allegory was a new and, well, not new, but at least an effective method, perhaps they didn't realize the outcome of undermining the structures on which their society was built. That's worth thinking about. So, again, theological, textual, and last, and like I said to you, really the most important, was practical. There's an accusation that they had become lax on the mitzvot. It's hard to be a Jew, and it's even harder to keep the law. So therefore, once I begin undermining both the theological and the textual basis for why God would care and how God actually commanded your ancestors at Sinai to do something, so then it's just not going to be so easy to stand up to the challenges of daily life and live as a Jew. And then the social fabric begins to fray, and things tend to fall apart fairly quickly from there. So these are the backbone fight. You know, the Rosh succeeds, as I said, in convincing the Rashba to declare this cherem, but it is only effective in further splitting Jewish society. Right? Meaning you'll have now a solidification of the traditionalist camp with the gradual but increasing adherence or transformation into what we would call the mystics camp. Because the Zohar and the mysticism which it represents will begin to supply, as I pointed out to you, right, the heart and soul of the myth of the Zohar is that the human being is the keystone of creation. And that through your individual actions, you are able to bring down the divine effluence, right? The God creates the whole world through emanations, but it's the actions of the moral, conscious human being that allows God's will and life force to flow through that whole structure. Do you see how this is the exact opposite of the philosophers? Right? Theologically speaking, you can do miracles and bring Messiah through your actions. So not only is it true, but it's on you. It's not just an abstract concept, but you can make it happen. That, by the way, will receive its most powerful articulation in Sfat in the 16th century and will be exactly what explodes in the Sabbatean Revolution in the 17th. But meanwhile, what it does is it counters the theological. The textual, well, you know, the mystics always read the text as what we would call hyperliteral. I mean, it's not just a true story. Now I want to know, when Avraham looked out across Sodom, how is he standing? Because how he stood is how you stand before God. So I want to stand that way. And you know, when Hagar turned away and didn't want to hear Ishmael, what did that feel like? When God said, well, Asher hu sham, right? I hear him where he is. So, by the way, we read that on Yom Kippur because we're hoping, sorry, on Rosh Hashanah, because we're hoping that God will hear us just like God heard Ishmael. Right? Meaning the mystic is always into hyper-literalism. So therefore, this idea of allegorization of the text is anathema. Mythologization of it is fine. Remember what I told you? That recognizing that within there's a topography of a divine drama which underlies the stories of Avraham and Sarah, just like they underlie the stories of me and my family, that's great. Because not only does it not undermine the text, it makes it all that much more relevant. Right? This is why the Alter Rebbe would tell you, and I hope you've all heard this before, you should always look for yourself in the weekly Parsha. Right? You know this idea that you're supposed to finish the Parsha together with all of Am Yisrael every week? So he adds to that, what does that really mean? Every week when you're reading the Parsha, it's about you. You think about that is classic mythic thinking. How could this Parsha be about me? Even if I believe it was given to God, sorry, by God to Moshe at Sinai, exactly as written, but like, how is it about me? How is it possible not only, okay, when it's about me, how could it be about you? Right? Like, and not only that, how could it be about some Jew in the Rhineland in the 14th century? The answer is because there's a topography. There's a mythic topography which underlies the stories of the Torah, which underlie my world, which underlie the 14th century, which underlie the 28th century. That this is the baseline of reality. So that knocks the textual problem right out of the block. It gives us what you are after in allegory, because it allows you to get that esoteric inner meaning, but it does it without necessitating that you strip away the outer meaning and make it meaningless. And last but certainly not least, the mystics are the ones for whom every action matters, particularly commanded action. Conscious commanded action becomes the way in which creation reaches fruition. So you see why, in this fight, the traditionalist camp, once the Zohar and the whole thinking of the Girona school begins to permeate a certain layer of their society, furthermore, life is getting bad. The high life of the elite will continue, but the economics are dropping out from the bottom. There's a whole democratic struggle, which maybe we will or won't go into in what are known as the name in Spanish, the Jewish civil courts and communal structures, an attempt, which we see throughout Jewish history, for the average people to begin to try to take more control from the wealthy and intellectual elite. And there's a lot of social struggles, which, according to Gershom Scholem, is one of the backbones of the Zohar's message, right, what we would call sort of a spiritual social justice element. Right, so there's all kinds, and we spoke about why mysticism is really that light that comes out of darkness. So hopefully you can see there why then the Zohar and the world it represents would easily slide in and become the base for this new society. So there's a deep split that's developing, and into that split there's just... Okay, I'll tell you one more story, and then maybe we'll leave the tour and legalism, because I said there's two things we need to talk about. There's mysticism and legalism. Because the other thing that's happening is that the corpus of Jewish thought is just so vast, right? The Rosh brings the whole knowledge base of the Tosafists. Now remember, everyone in Ashkenaz, most people, of course, were just living their life as Jews the way they lived it because that's how they lived it. The scholarly class were the inheritors of the Torah of Ashkenaz. Now they had encountered the Rambam at a certain point, perhaps, is an old question there, but let's just assume they encountered the Rambam. The Ramban's works began via Provence to work their way up, but it was nothing compared to what happened to the Rosh when he actually met the Rashba. And it was like, just picture, this is like if they had been fighting, this is, I don't know, think of some prize fight. This is the embodiment of Torah Ashkenaz and Torah Sfarad, meaning, what? Ali Frazier, fine. Right, I don't want to pick who gets to be who, right? And so the necessity to reconcile between two traditions which had developed in parallel over hundreds of years became pressing, because you think it was hard to decide between the Ashkenazi, you know, commentators and post-game. Now what do you do? Right? What's that?
Why did the Rashba agree to do what the Rosh asked? He can have people living in a whole different cultural environment.
Well, but he saw the dangers that the Rosh was highlighting. Meaning, this is a classic situation. The Rashba is part of the intellectual elite of Spain. Now, he's the Rashba, so he's not getting drawn behaviorally into, right, the laxity of practice, and unlikely that he had the textual or theological issues. Although we know that the Rashba was a moderate, interestingly enough, I didn't mention this, but it's worth knowing. You know what the practical issue that caused all the fight was? Astral magic. Astral magic was the cutting-edge healing technology of the early 14th century. And it involved effigies and like all kinds of like magic spells. Now here's the thing. Who was in favor of astral magic? The traditionalists or the philosophers? The philosophers. Right? Because it was seen to be part of what we would call natural philosophy. Right? And furthermore, it didn't depend on God. Right? It was magic. Now, the Rashba actually was not entirely opposed. So he actually was part of this middle camp. But you know what happens to the middle camp when the fanatic from Ashkenaz shows up? That's what the Rosh, I mean, in that context, that's what Rosh becomes. Rosh, remember I pointed out to you, the culture of the Tosafists, they didn't know who Aristotle was. Right? I have a quote here. Where is it? Rosh said, right, he says, he says, you know, he quotes Mishle, none that go that way may return. Right, raglecha yordod ma, that her feet go down to death, and he's legendarily supposed to have thanked God for having been saved from the influence of Aristotle and possessing no knowledge outside of Torah. That should sound familiar, right? Yeah, but you have to understand that when when someone like Rav Kanievsky or et cetera makes the statements against secular knowledge that they're making, he's fully aware that the Rosh fought this battle, lost, and that the culture of Iberian Judaism was crushed, perhaps because of it. Now, that last piece is an important question that we're going to deal with, but just realize that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. Right, the modern, meaning current day, not modern Orthodox, but the current day Orthodox world has a largely ahistorical worldview in terms of the evolutionary concepts that I've been putting out there. But that doesn't mean that they're ignorant of the past. Right, and so therefore you should appreciate that the Rosh shows up and says, "Thank God, I've never opened a book of philosophy, and I know exactly what the Torah wants of us." And I'm telling you, Rashba, who have a lot more empathy for this culture, that the time has come to draw the battle lines, and the Rashba agreed. One of the reasons the Rashba agreed is the last story I'll tell you guys, is that there was, as I said, a tremendous upwelling of messianism. Right? There was a lot of desperation. The end of the 13th, early 14th century was a difficult time for everyone, much less the Jews. And Rashba, in one of his Tshuvot, right, speaks about the prophet of Avila. Avila is a city in Christian Spain, right? And he speaks in general about the messianic fervor that was sweeping through Am Yisrael in the year 1295. This is before the Rosh shows up, right? Now, apparently, this prophet of Avila, who was both ignorant and illiterate, nevertheless had visions and dreams in which an angel dictated him something called the Book of Wisdom, right? Of Wondrous Wisdom. And he claims that the Rashba claims that one of his correspondents had sent him a 50-chapter synopsis. Sorry, a synopsis of his 50 chapters. It was a massive work, right? Now, lest you think that this all came to naught, that we have another record of the prophet of Avila, because the Rashba just notes it and doesn't tell us what happened. There was a physician in Burgos. He lived in Burgos, right? There was a physician in Burgos by the name of Avner, right, who reports in his notes that in the year 1295, that the Jews of his city and of many cities in Spain were possessed with the notion that there was going to be a blast of the Messiah's horn that would summon the Jews out of exile on the last day of Tammuz in the year 5055, that's 1295 in the Christian calendar. And so all the Jews get very excited. And apparently it swept, particularly the Jews of Burgos, right? They show up in shul all dressed in white as if it's Yom Kippur, waiting for the redemption. And what happens, according to his account? Suddenly, everyone's clothing becomes covered in crosses. This is what he records. Not only their clothes, but even the clothes back home in their clothing chests, all covered with crosses. And he spends the next several days treating people in shock, we would say, from this obvious reversal of fortune, that from Messiah to heresy. And over the next 25 years, it eats away at him. Now, he's a physician. He's a Jew, but he's educated in philosophy. He's also exposed to Christian doctrine from working within royal circles. 25 years after this event, he converts. He becomes Alfonso of Valladolid, becomes a great opponent of the Jews. He actually has the dubious distinction of convincing Alfonso the 11th of Castile in 1336 to ban the Aleinu prayer. If you've ever noticed, in many Sidurim, There's right, that line that they bow to emptiness and nothing, while we, that line is either excised entirely or in some places in brackets. So that is a remnant of the fact that since the early 14th century, Jews, apostate Jews, have been convincing Christian authorities that that line refers to Jesus of Nazareth. Okay? This is symptomatic, I use that pun intentionally with the doctor, right, is symptomatic of a condition which is about to sweep Christian Spain. Because just to tell you where we're headed from here. So now, we've had this rupture and reconstruction pattern. We've got to follow Ashkenaz off into Poland, right, where they're largely, by the way, going to leave this philosophical issue far behind, although the Kabbalah will follow them there, right? So, but we also need to play out to a limited degree what happens in Iberia. Because I've introduced to you one of the pieces that begins to emerge into this space, this piece of mysticism. But we haven't really discussed legalism. How is it that the minds, the leading sort of religious minds of the Iberian Peninsula, are able to integrate what the Rosh appears with and what the Rashba is already brought to its height. That will happen in the person of the Tur, the Rosh's son, Rav Yaakov ben Asher, but we're going to have to speak about him next week. So we'll stop there, and we will pick up the story next week. Oh yeah, Purim Sameach, everyone.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.